Ahoy, authors! You're listening to the Writership Podcast, a show focused on helping indie authors master self-editing skills. So come aboard and get ready to find the treasure in your manuscript with hosts Leslie Watts and Clark Chamberlain.
Welcome to episode 103 of the Writership Podcast. Today, we're going to be talking about narrative identity. I'm Leslie Watts, here with Clark Chamberlain from The Book Editor Show. To learn more about the podcast, visit writership.com/podcast.
As you know, the Writership Podcast is brought to you by Jim Kukral and Author Marketing Club. Jim has just launched a new business for nonfiction authors called Business Around a Book. So if you're a nonfiction author, visit www.businessaroundabook.com and let Jim help you turn your nonfiction book into a profitable, life-changing business. That's businessaroundabook.com.
Hey, Clark.
Hey, how's it going, Leslie?
It's going. It's going.
When does the kids get out of the school for the summers down there?
Well, this is a funny thing. At our particular school, this is the last week. So I am scrambling to get things settled, get a few things done. You know,
I am in the same boat. So the tall one gets out on Thursday and the short one gets out on Friday. And I'm like, summer cannot be here already.
Yeah. May?
I must have missed
what?
It. Yeah.
End of May? No way. Come on. Yeah.
So that'll add some fun to the home working.
Yes. Yes. And no doubt we'll have a cameo or two in future episodes for your enjoyment.
Mm-hmm. For sure. So, I also wanted to mention, you know, don't forget to get out the 100 quick writing tips. That's a free download. Big thank you for all these last episodes. Go to writership.com/quicktips and you can grab that.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, as you mentioned at the beginning there, Jim Kukral and Author Marketing Club cover hosting and technical support for the podcast, but we're inviting listeners to sponsor our time in producing the show and engage with us in a different way. So to find out more about that, you can go to patreon.com/writership. And this week, we have our first Patreon shout out from E.A. Hennessy, who's the author of Grigory's Gadget, which is a steampunk novel. Quite fun. I hope you'll check it out. An earlier version of the opening of Grigory's Gadget was actually appeared in episode 2 of the podcast.
Ooh.
Yeah. Yes. So you can find out more about E.A. Hennessy and read her blog at www.eahennessy.com. That's EAHENNESSY.com. Thanks so much for your support.
Yeah, thank you so much, EA. That's awesome. So,
all right.
I know. So, I don't know if you wanted a quote or not this week.
Do you have a quote that touches on narrative identity?
I do, from Daniel Siegel. And Daniel says, stories are the way we make sense out of the events of our lives. Individually and collectively, we tell stories in order to understand what has happened to us and to create meaning from those experiences. Storytelling is fundamental to all human cultures, and our shared stories create a connection to others that builds a sense of belonging to a particular community. The stories of a particular culture shape how its members perceive the world. In this way, stories both are created by us and shape who we are. For these reasons, stories are central to both individual and collective human experience. It's deep.
Yeah.
And it's so real. Like, if you don't understand how powerful story has been in shaping the world, shaping your own life, and making sense of it, like, you really need to get on board with that, especially if you're an author. Then you can really start to understand the power you have in the stories that you're telling.
Yeah, and I think also that when you have a lot of turmoil or kind of misunderstood events and happenings from your past, that these things, they'll kind of flow unconsciously into your writing. I mean, who we are and what we bring and our experiences and our worldview and all of that, of course, ends up in our writing. But if we can be really intentional about it, then I think we can shape our stories and really find lovely ways to connect with our readers and to communicate the things that we really want to say, rather than, you know, which is not to say that everything should be scripted and, well, I'm going to, I have a message that I want to say in this story, and so I'm going to work all around that. But just when we are clearer about our own personal experience and the things that have happened to us, then we can understand our own stories and how we relate to story in general better, I think.
No, I totally agree with that. You know, writing in Iraq for me was this type of outlet, you know, being able to, and that's a completely fictionalized story, mm-hmm. but I asked questions in there that I was dealing with, you know, like things in my mind and things that were, I was experiencing, and I put it into a fictional form so that I could have a conversation, because I was in a position where I certainly couldn't write what was actually going on. I would, you know, the army wouldn't be good with that, you know, because they have a lot of rules on what you can talk about, mm-hmm. but I could do it in fiction, and I could put it someplace else that, that allowed me to actually work through some of it. And sometimes, because I think in the quote, you know, that there's a really big message in this quote, and that is that we create meaning, that we want to have meaning with everything that happens in our life and an understanding of why. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes we'll have events in our life that happen, which we can't explain, we can't put meaning to, we're really trying to work through. And this can be a way, like sitting down and actually writing through it can be a way to help you actually sort that out and figure it out and be able to, because that's after I got home. But PTSD followed me back from Iraq, mm-hmm. and I worked through a lot, and actually it took a couple of years and got with the right counselor, and we started doing this type of writing again. I didn't understand it at the time, what I was doing in Iraq, but trying it again there and being able to work through the events that were really kind of holding me back and were giving me the most problems, and try to find a reason, like being able to put the reason with that and of the story. And so it can help. This can be very helpful to your own personal life, being able to work through story.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, well, I should explain where this quote comes from, because Daniel Siegel is not a fiction author or a writing teacher. He's actually a doctor, and he co-wrote a book called Parenting from the Inside Out. And it's a lot of it is about how, and this is how I encountered this idea of narrative identity, though it wasn't called that when I was looking into it. When you become a parent and you have all these ideas about how you're going to parent and you're going to do it this way and not this other way, that your own experience of being parented and your early experiences with life and how you were treated and how you make sense of those things actually impacts your parenting in the present moment and in really big ways. And I had no idea about that until I started looking at this and then understanding how important it is that we make sense of and kind of work through the hard stuff so that it's not coming out unconsciously in the things mm-hmm. we do and say, how we relate to people. And then, of course, because our fiction is all, you know, it's all about what we do and say, whether the story is very plot-based or more character-based, then it's so important. So it really, really helps for us to understand that.
Mm-hmm. It really does. And if you're interested in learning more about narrative identity, You can go online and just look up narrative identity, but a couple of books that I would definitely suggest is How Our Lives Become Stories. That's by Paul John Eakin, E-A-K-I-N. And then also Living Autobiographically, How We Create Identity in Narrative, by also Paul John Eakin. So those are a couple of excellent books on this, but they're more on the scientific side of things, so they might be a little dry to learn more about it.
Yeah, cool. So the story we have for you for today is actually, it came to us from an author whose son was going to, he joined the army and he was going to Afghanistan in, he told us, a unit that was in a particularly rough spot. You've probably heard of the Khyber Pass in Afghanistan if you followed the news of the war. And you know, for a parent to see their child going into these dangerous situations, it's not a new thing, but it is a, you know, it's wow. Like, I get, my son is young, not eligible for the draft or any of that sort of thing yet. But I get, you know, I have feelings when I think about this and hear other people's stories, other parents' stories. So you can kind of, you know, get a feel for it, not only as you're, Clark, have had the experience of going over there and trying to make sense of it, but then also as the people who are at home and worrying and thinking about that, and that's a lot to work through. And so our author, Tim LaFave, one of the ways that he worked through his worry and frustration with the whole situation was to write a story, and so, which I think is amazing and wonderful, because I think writing obviously helps us work through these things, but we also, just the act of writing, if we're not working on a story, helps us work through things. So this was really wonderful for us to read and kind of get a feel for it. And it's a lovely story too. I mean, lovely, I use that word, like, the character goes through a lot and it has a very painful experience. And so when I say lovely, what I really mean is that it touched me deeply as I read it. And so, so I'm curious about, like, how does that work? And what does, you know, how can I use my own deeply emotional experiences to touch readers in, you know, in both positive ways and then to, in, you know, ways that touch the harder feelings that we deal with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And this is a really good example of being able to get in and, to talk about things. Yeah. Are we ready to start?
Well, let me see. So this is a short story. It's called A Hero Least of All. The author is Tim LaFave, and I would call this literary fiction. The word count on the whole story is 4,325, and the excerpt that Clark is going to read is from the second half of the story.
And just as a little background, this young man has had nicknames his whole life. So Smurf was one of the nicknames that he's received in the earlier chapters. So if it comes up, that's who we're talking about. Mm-hmm. So starting chapter 3. Smurf had almost made it through basic training when he received his longest and most long-lasting nickname. He was becoming a soldier, a small young man standing 5'9" in his socks. Michael had been just short of 145 pounds when he joined up. Now he weighed 152 pounds of hardened muscle. There was no fat on his body. He liked how he looked in his boxers and wife-beater t-shirt. He had light brown hair that streaked tan highlights in the summer. His eyes were large and dark, sort of an undecided gray slash hazel, which in certain light looked first one, then another color altogether. They were set in deep sockets, and the skin around them was slightly darker than his otherwise swarthy olive-brown complexion. This gave him a dirty look somehow, even when he had just showered. His features were otherwise even and unremarkable. He was short, dark, and average. He was solitary, inscrutable. He had no close friends and tended to keep to himself, usually only speaking when spoken to. He did not often join, a conversation, and when he did, he usually mumbled something mysterious. He was awkward. He just was, and there seemed no fixing it. Most of the time, if he did volunteer something, it was usually off point. This wasn't because he didn't know what he thought, though he was by no means a deep thinker. It was more that he was socially inept. Being so, he thought out of the box, so to speak, and being awkward, his statements were often misunderstood, like they were some foreign language badly interpreted. The rest of the guys mostly ignored him because they didn't get where he was coming from. They thought he was stupid, unworthy of the effort to demystify, to unravel, and so they didn't try. Eyes rolled dismissively, and snickers and ribald jesting sent him back into himself whenever he came out with one of his more unfortunate gaffes. The occasion that earned him this new nickname was during the week of field orientation training. The platoon was all taken out into the field for a week's training program to learn how to live off the land, set up camp, set up a perimeter, eat MREs, sleep on the ground in all weather, and mostly learn the Army way of camping, which spoiled camping forever after for more than one recruit. One of the main exercises was land nav, whereby each recruit was issued a compass and a topographical map and some rudimentary instructions on the use thereof. With this, it was meant for each soldier to learn how to orient himself to the map and his natural surroundings and navigate from point A to point B to point C, and so on and so forth for each of his missions. Each squad was given an assigned navigation mission and sent off under its various squad leaders. These were young recruits, just like Smurf himself. Usually they were selected because of some slight advantage over the other raw recruits, like a better score on the previous week's training exercise, or some perceived advantage or quality of leadership. Sometimes, perhaps more often than not, it was because a certain recruit won the grudging admiration of a drill sergeant, because maybe he saw something in him that reminded the officer of himself. This was the case with Smurf's squad leader. He was a jerk that resembled something in the drill sergeant, who was himself a jerk of the first order. They had been at their assigned navigation mission for the better part of the day. It would be dark in about 3 hours, and they were nowhere near as close to their rendezvous with its cache of MREs and dinner time break as they should have been. Smurf had been doing his best to keep up, but it seemed to him that the rest of the squad had entered into an unspoken conspiracy to lose him. On top of that, he had to urinate. He had been needing to do so ever since half an hour after they had finished with lunch and resumed their march, which meant that he'd been holding back his water for 3.5 hours. His bladder felt like it would burst with each step. He reached the point of desperation, and he could no longer hold it. Announcing his need, the squad halted so that he might relieve himself. He found a tree sufficiently large enough to go behind, some 40 or 50 feet away. Any one of the others would have simply unzipped his ACUs and taken care of business then and there, but Smurf was self-conscious. While he was urinating, his stream flowed like a fountain that would not stop. It was a very satisfying feeling, and his body shook and tingled with it, but it took too long for the impatient young man who was designated squad leader. With a quick jerk of his neck, he signaled the others to follow him, which they did, a little too enthusiastically, snickering as they went. When Smurf emerged from behind the tree, ripping at his zipper fly as he came, he saw that he was all alone. They had gone and left him behind. Neither did his increasingly frantic calls bring them back. They heard him for a few minutes as his cries faded in the woods behind him, but they did not answer back. They giggled amongst themselves with satisfaction over the great joke they were playing on their erstwhile teammate, but they did not wait or call him back. That would have spoiled their malicious fun. Ah, let him find us, the squad leader said. We aren't very far from the rendezvous, and he has his map and compass. He's supposed to know how to use them. Let him find his own way. So they left him to his own devices, and since he didn't have a clue how the whole map and compass thing worked, he floundered about in circles until dark. He was lost in the woods and would stay so for days. This caused a brigade-sized army manhunt with helicopters and everything. It created a disruption to the mission, putting planned maneuvers on hold while this crisis was sorted out. Not to say that things did not go well for his squad mates, who, despite the stories they tried to come up with in their defense, even by placing all the blame on Michael, they were not found blameless, because it is an unwritten military code that when one soldier messes up, they all mess up and are all treated alike to the same punishment. Smurf had stumbled into a swamp in the thickest part of the wooded course and some miles outside of the normal area of operations. While he finally emerged 3 days later, he was scratched and bruised and covered from head to toe with swamp mud. But he emerged on his own, triumphant. The army, despite its best efforts, never found him. He had subsisted on berries and wild onions, of which there were plenty, and he had finally figured out how to use his map and compass by reading and rereading the instruction card that he had been issued. And so after days of searching, a massive manhunt, and countless effort, Smurf came out of the woods and hit his assigned rendezvous point just about time for supper. He stumbled into camp, ghost-like, in his unearthly combination of quietness and dirt, and sat down on a log near the fire pit with his map and compass in hand. His first sergeant, who happened to be there directing the rescue operation in that quadrant, turned in time to see him sit down. At first, his jaw dropped and flexed a few times. Nothing came out, although he desperately wanted it to come barking out instead of mute, helpless silence. Stunned, he turned and approached Smurf disbelievingly. Mucklemeyer, where the devil have you been? How in Hades did you get here? It was as solicitous as the drill sergeant had ever been. It was solicitation born of fear and relief. And for a moment, Michael felt safe. He grinned, and without rising to his feet, he showed the first sergeant his map and then pointed to the swamp feature on it as he jiggled the compass in his hand. Sir, I was lost, but I navigated on my own and found my way out. Stories went around the camp that evening about how old Smurf got lost and lived on berries and wild onions and camped all night by himself in the dark woods. But he was a survivor. Though no one said it, more than a few thought to himself, man, I'm not sure I could have got out of there by myself with just a map and compass. And so a grudging respect was earned by Michael, along with a sure-footed land nav skill and a new nickname, Mickey Muck and Meyer. This they called him when they were feeling in a charitable mood. It was the first name that had ever been given him that showed any respect, and he didn't mind at all when they used it. Chapter 4. Muck and Meyer, Mickey Murphy, Muck and Meyer, shouted the first sergeant, who was engaged in the weekly routine of mail call, a task heavily laced with sarcasm and not a little sadistic pleasure in the dispensing of push-ups. This drill sergeant, Staples, seemed to be losing its edge, however slightly, as the recruits had begun to settle into acceptable indifference. There didn't seem to be a great delight in the hazing. The sport had gone all out of it. This was good news for guys like Smurfy, always the last to be subjected to it, and who would suffer it the longest. He had a letter from home, his second in 7 weeks, and the first one from his mother. It lasted an entire half page, 3 1/2 paragraphs of bad grammar and tortured spelling about nothing much of interest. Hi, Michael. How are you doing? We are fine. Sis has a new boyfriend, and Bubba don't have no job still. I would have sent and some cookies or something, but I checked the postage and it was too much. Hope you are all right. I packed up all your stuff in your room. What would you like to do with it? Love, Mom. And so it went. Life moves on. In his case, it moved as swiftly as a flash flood, sweeping helpless campers down a valley of death, like so many pup tents and Coleman coolers bobbing and tumbling in its relentless, tuggered grip. It was Sunday, mail call always being on the weekend. He had 1 hour of personal time just before lights out, an hour in which to treasure, a little time to read, write, reflect, or just doze. He must doze, not sleep, because the army had not released him to sleep just yet. And if he should doze, he must do it carefully, lest he get caught and be smoked yet once again before the day was out, which was what most of the recruits did, at least those farthest from the door of the barracks, sleep being a precious luxury. Michael stretched himself across his bunk and read and reread the letter from his mother, and then read the other one from his brother. These two letters formed the nucleus of memories from a previous life, one that, though only a few weeks ago was his own, now seemed to have belonged to something, someone else he once knew. Not that he had much time to think of home. The demands of basic training kept him too worn out. But these moments when he was allowed to be on his own, these priceless golden moments following the weekend mail call, flooded him with waves of nostalgia that infected him with a virus called homesickness. It felt so bad sometimes. He felt like he would throw up. Unmanly tears leaked unbidden from the corners of his eyes and slid their way mercilessly down his cheeks to drip from his chain to the letter in his hand. He often brushed them away with a motion of his hand, much like that of swatting away an annoying insect. Eternally grateful that most of the other recruits were nodding off or too deep in their own heads to bother with him, Michael carefully folded his creased treasures and reinserted the limp pages into the dog-eared envelopes before returning them to his footlocker. He would have preferred to keep them under his pillow, and he did a couple of times when the homesickness was particularly bad. He would slip his hand under his pillow and let his fingertips find them. But he was too fearful of them being found and confiscated by the sergeants or one of the other recruits. He didn't want to lose them. And he was aware of the mischief they could cause him if they fell into the wrong hands. They were too priceless to risk losing, and his attachment to them, which grew by the day, was too shameful a secret to risk being found out. It was not that the actual fact of Michael's life mattered that much to his family, nor that he fit in that well anywhere at all. He knew this, knew it without bitterness. He was not angry that he was not missed by them as much as he missed them. He was just grateful to have had some place to think of his home. He could have made it on a park bench or in a refrigerator box in an alley if needs be, but he was glad for what he had been given. The letters and the thoughts of home were an anchor. By them, he was connected to the shore. He may have been only a minor planet at the far reaches of his personal solar system, but at least he was attached to something. He clung to his position mentally, desperately, with a resolve never to be flung out of his orbit. But the gravity that attracts and binds stellar systems together was, in this case, casual. Forces beyond his control, forces which he had never understood, threatened to fling him beyond the stellar cluster. Smurfy would never be a star, or even a light planet. At best, he had become a planetoid.
Okay. So, yeah, again, that's a hero least of all. And I'm a little concerned that it loses some of its power by not hearing the opening. But I wanted to include the ending because that's where it is most powerful. You know, like it builds mm-hmm. to that, and the moment, the big moment in this short story is, of course, when he walks into camp and he gets the nickname for the first time that, you know, has some respect for him that mm-hmm. is, that acknowledges something positive, you know, and is involved with something that he actually did versus something somebody just made up or some, you know, some weird connection someone made. Mm-hmm. That's what, you know, as you mentioned in the beginning, that he gets lots of nicknames, and some of the nicknames come from his, he has half siblings who are not very nice, and I don't like them very much. I mean, they're all just people, but I feel like I immediately upon reading the story felt a connection in a way to Michael's character. And I think that this is really what people talk about when they talk about Write What You Know, is not that I'm saying that the author has experienced this precise experience, but we've all had certain emotional experiences, and that when we can kind of connect with those and remember how it felt to be in that position, that we can write a character who is in a different position but feeling a similar emotion, and that we can really get into that feeling to make a connection with the reader.
Right, because and this is stuff that I teach in the Punch Him in the Gut, Writing Fiction with Emotional Impact, is the necessity to have your protagonist connect at a level with the reader. And this is an easy thing to do, like when you're in middle grade fiction or YA fiction, because as an author, you think back, okay, well, what was going on during those years of my life or my friends' lives or whatever in that time period? And it's easy to grab those. Because we have those same feelings. We all have those types of experiences as we grow up at these different ages, and we can insert those. But what happens is when we get older, we kind of forget, you know, that there is still this thing called life that kind of goes along at the same speed that everyone's living. Mm-hmm. But if we can do that, if we can take a look, all right, so my character, my protagonist, he's this 32-year-old male. You know, what was I doing at 32? What was my friends doing at 32? What kind of life experiences were happening? And in being able to add those in, like, just that's what connects the reader to that character. That's what really gets them, is because they're like, oh, wow, they understand me. They have this. And reading through this story, that feeling of trying to find family, trying to find where you fit in, you know, that you at least have something. Even though it's not exactly what you want, you have some place. Like, that feeling that it can be really universal for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. You know, that feeling of trying to find a place where they fit.
Yeah. Even if the reader hasn't had an experience that is so extreme as Michael's, mm-hmm. where he feels like he doesn't really fit in. And, you know, within his family or his community or in the, you know, in his army unit, that we've all had those experiences where we felt disconnected and on the outside. And we probably all had the experience of being called a name that we didn't enjoy. Yes, I was thinking, oh, I've never had that. And then I remembered and I was like, oh, yeah, I'm not going to share it. But but that is it's so powerful. And I feel like I'm going on and on about it. But the things that we can relate to Michael, even if we haven't felt the depth of his, you know, painful experience, because mm-hmm. we've had similar experiences. And I think actually making them a little more extreme in a story makes them, you know, that sort of larger than life. We have a larger than life, essentially small character who has had, you know, has had painful experiences, as opposed to like a sort of, you know, the anti-hero, mm-hmm. essentially, and not the hero, although he gets this moment where he, you know, where everyone's like, hey, well done.
Yeah. Yeah. And like what you were saying, I really do like what you're saying about like making it bigger, because when you're trying to pick these types of experiences, you know, that people have most likely had, if you make it too easy, like maybe he's just has some kind of weird nicknames or something, or, you know, maybe he doesn't get along with one person, mm-hmm. like that's easy to dismiss. But when you can make it so that, like at the first of this story where he is like really out of place with his family, you know, they gave him these weird nicknames, and it doesn't seem like he has any kind of closeness. Now he's in the military, and it's the same type of thing, and now it's bigger. You got an entire group like walking away from you in the woods because they want to leave you behind. Like, when you can make that extreme like that, mm-hmm. then no one can be like, oh, he could have gotten through that easy enough because I did. You know, like, when it's much more extreme, then it's even easier to feel like, oh, wow, yeah, he's really going through a lot. And I've gone through something similar, but it was smaller. And I can understand that feeling.
Yeah. And it just occurred to me, it sort of gives you permission to go, yeah, that was hard. Even though my experience wasn't like that. Mm-hmm. It's that, you know, it gives us a connection. And I think this works, and I meant to make this point earlier, that story works both ways. That when we read a story like this, it helps us kind of make sense of, oh yeah, that's why that bothered me. That was really crappy when they did that. And I kind of laughed it off at the time, but it was painful. And how do mm-hmm. I want to make sense of that today? So it works that way, but it also works the other way, because we've all known someone like Michael, haven't we? Who's a little awkward, is, you know, seems out of it, might seem a little slow, doesn't really kind of get, you know, like, doesn't really jump in and join in and do that deftly. And when when you're a kid, you know, you clumsily try to help those other kids. And then as an adult, you can see it, everything, I think, more clearly. And you read a story like that and you remember, right, everybody's going through their own stuff and somebody might be just having a hard time and that, and we can understand other people a little bit mm-hmm. better, especially when we read about circumstances that are outside of our experience, but where we can relate to the character nonetheless.
Mm-hmm. And I think that that's one of the greatest things to help us understand that we're a lot more alike than we are different. Mm-hmm. When we can get in and read things like this. For me, I was 17 turning 18 and moved to California, and I'd grown up in the West, and, you know, during the time, the 80s and early 90s, I mean, we didn't have a lot of movement going on. There wasn't a lot of diversity. And so how does a guy, you know, how does a white kid growing up in a bowl of white rice, you know, understand something like the civil rights movement? And I picked up the autobiography of Malcolm X when I was in California, and it's a very storytelling type book, you know, like, it's all story about himself. And it showed me a different world. I was able to enter a different world and have some semblance of understanding that I didn't have before, because mm-hmm. I could connect the emotional things, and there were parts of his life that I could connect with and I could understand, you know, that were happened to me. And then other things that didn't. And so those other things that didn't gives you, you know, gives the reader experience into a new world, because they can connect with the things that do, you know. And that's what you're trying to do, is you're trying to give this new experience by helping them feel normal in the old experience. It's exactly the same reason why most sci-fi books, the aliens, you know, if you're on an alien world or whatever, or some other place, they're humanoid. There's something about them that's human, something about them that makes them more normal for us to understand, because if it was all way too alien, we wouldn't get it. We wouldn't understand it at all. We have to have something to anchor us to the story.
Yes, precisely. And I think that the same, so we can't, yeah, if you're dealing with a speculative world or, you know, things like that, that you need some way to connect it to, obviously, reader's experience here on Earth. And it works the other way too, that when we're writing about, I'm not sure actually that this is a direct corollary, but it's there's some weird connection in my mind between these two concepts. And that is that when we are drawing on our personal experiences, that we not make them directly autobiographical, mm-hmm. that we, you know, everything is still in service of the story that we're trying to tell, and that it, you know, telling the direct story, unless we're writing a memoir or something, you know, like unless we're writing nonfiction, then we want to make sure that we are serving the story and not only telling precisely what happened to us. So there might be some things that you would need to tweak and change, and that you wouldn't want to necessarily, like, the plain events of a lot of our lives just told fact aren't a story.
No. In the same way that you wouldn't write dialogue like we actually speak.
Right.
Because it would be boring. It would be filled with ums and pauses and all this incorrect way of speaking. But it's always making something bigger, something better than what it is there.
Yeah, and really cutting it down to its essence, mm-hmm. and stripping away the mundane sorts of things. And I'm wanting to be more specific about that in regard to this specific story or another one. And I'm having a little trouble with that right now. Do you have a thought?
So one thought that I do have right at this moment about the narrative identity. So I want to be clear on this, that we're talking about two separate types of things. The idea of going in and writing down your own stories, like your real life stories, in a deal like narrative identity, where you're trying to actually establish what about those stories is holding you back or what about those stories has built you up, is different than applying things in your life that are real to a fictional one that you're going to try to share with other people. Because the one can be something that's just totally for yourself, mm-hmm. you know, and you put in, write it however you want, like write it how you see it, like write it how the world is there and how you perceive the world through those stories that you have in your life. But yeah, like when we're moving over to the other side and we're going to do this on the commercial side, we don't want to just, because the truth of the world or the, you know, the real story is not going to be that interesting. You know, you need to be good at weaving, like cutting certain parts, like what is the, like what you were just saying, what's the essence of it? Mm-hmm. What is it you're really trying to say here? Mm-hmm. Is it too much yourself? You know, are you painting yourself? Like you have your own bias, like you've made this character and now you're going to add your own bias to it because you want people to understand the situation, how you see it. Or is it okay to let that character become something different than how you saw it? And let them grow. So, I mean, there's two different things here that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm so glad you made that distinction because I was allowing them to get a little bit mixed up. And I did come up with a couple of examples. One example is, now I've lost it. I'm finding it in the actual manuscript here. Okay. So there's a part in that comes before the part that you read where the narrator, right, we're in third person omniscient, talks about how his dream of Michael's dream of not, you know, of a clean slate doesn't live long, and that he, you know, the way it started with the way that he was addressed by his drill sergeants. And then there's a passage where he says he learned to say, sir, yes, sir, sergeant.
So the word is sergeant, but it's really weird because they pronounce it, yes, sergeant, like, or here first are, like, it's almost like you lose all those middle vowels or consonants in the center there, and it's sar. Uh-huh. So, but okay. Yes, the word is sergeant, but it's just how, I don't know why, and it's, I've only seen it down in the South, and there's a lot of drill sergeants from the South. So
interesting fact.
Yeah, and so it's a, yep. Yeah, so it's a lot of, how the, I can't even think what you call it when you have accent. Right. So it's a lot with the accent.
Right. Okay. So then he learned to say that, sir, yes, sir, sarn't, or sir, no, sir, sarn't, when being addressed. The simple rule of basic training seemed to be to agree expeditiously to whatever the sergeant said and to do so while maintaining the smallest possible profile in the Army officer radar. So this is interesting, but it in a short story of 4,500 words, it's not, it doesn't feel immediately relevant. And so that's one of those things that I would actually recommend, you know, like even if that's true and even if that's, you know, like I said, something that's kind of interesting and part of the backstory, we wouldn't necessarily include it. And there were some instances in the beginning where we were getting some backstory that seemed like we couldn't write, we couldn't make sense of it, and it wasn't immediately relevant. So we, you know, so looking at those things are part of what you do when you're taking a personal experience. And I'm not saying that this is necessarily, I do not have any information about how much of this was the author's personal experience or may have been related to his son. So I'm not saying that too, but it brings to mind the thought that when you're translating, when you take your personal experience or that of someone you know of and use that in your story, that you want to look at the parts that don't actually serve the story like you would with any narrative and take those out to make it tighter.
Yeah, because you want to keep the reader engaged so that they can have the emotional experiences that you're trying to share with them.
Right. So I will have more notes in the manuscript about, you know, specifically for this author and suggestions for tightening some of the prose. And we didn't talk a lot about that today. But Clark, you and I, we've talked about this a lot around the edges of different stories. And we've been kind of itching to talk about this, how, like, the importance of story and why it's important to work on the craft and really, really get the story so that it's as powerful as it can be.
Yeah. Because
they're entertaining, but they're also, within the entertainment, you have this very powerful platform way of making sense.
Yeah, to deliver a message without it being, and the moral of the story was, you know, like you have an ability to get in there and show people something different that's on your mind and in your heart.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
I also wanted, just before, I know we're running short on time here, but narrative identity. Like when you can really understand this, like I was saying before, you can really understand what story is, that we actually, the world that we've created right now, the world in your life right now is actually created by stories. You know, stories that you tell yourself, because you take 10 people, put them in the same room, give them an experience. You're going to have 10 different feelings that come out of it. Because we all take information from our past, we put it in there. And because of that, you do have the ability to edit your own life story. You can reinterpret how that is so that you can stop. So you can move past things that are really tough. You know, you can make yourself the hero in that portion of the story. You can rewrite it and get free of some of this stuff. Because a lot of times, well, I know in my own personal life, you know, I have stories that hold me back. And, you know, things that have happened in life and how I experienced them and how I interpreted them. And so being able to go through and do that, it's very powerful and it can give you new life.
Absolutely. And I think that is often true with artists, that we have lots of stories that hold us back from starting, finishing, publishing, and sharing our words with the world. And so it is, if you're struggling with that, then it's so important that you do, you know, write your own story out and change the ending. And it sounds kind of hocus pocus, woo woo, you know, like, oh, that's not going to change anything. But it is exactly what you're saying, that it's how we look at things that determines what we will do as a result. And so it's really important that we change the stories that limit us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of power in that. Mm-hmm. And if you ever have something that's holding you back from writing, and you need to get over that, because the world needs your voice. Mm-hmm. The world needs to hear your story. You need to contribute that to share with the world.
Yes.
Do you have an editorial mission for us that could go along with this?
I actually do. I'm going to run through it quickly because I know we spent a lot of time on this, but yeah. It felt really important. Okay, so what's your story? The more clearly we see and understand our own stories, the more we can use our own emotions to fuel the stories, make our characters relatable, and help connect with the reader. So first, look at your own life's journey and where you're at today. What are the stories that you tell yourself about your life and why you do what you do? And then look at one of the stories that you've written, and where does your story show up in there? And how can you bring more of your personal journey and the emotions to make your story more specific so that you can connect more deeply with your reader? So a reminder that you can find the editorial missions along with the critique and our notes for the author at writership.com/episodes. If you want to get the editorial missions delivered to your inbox, you can go there and sign up, which is a great option if you're usually on the go while you are listening.
And also remember, the Writership podcast is brought to you by Jim Kukral and Author Marketing Club. Jim has just launched a new business for nonfiction authors called Business Around a Book. So if you're a nonfiction author, visit www.businessaroundabook.com and let Jim help you turn your nonfiction book into a profitable, life-changing business. That's businessaroundabook.com.
And if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a rating and review on iTunes or Stitcher. The instructions for that you can find at writership.com. And if you want to have your 5 pages reviewed on the podcast, you can submit them at writership.com/submissions. Finally, be sure to check out the Book Editor Show. In the latest episode, Clark talks with David Mark Brown and Michael C. Clough from Fiction Vortex. That's it for episode 103. We'll see you next time on the Writership Podcast.
Ready for Leslie and Clark to help you find the treasure in your manuscript? Submit your pages to writership.org/podcast.